it's very important that we provide a little bit of context for this conversation. Mass incarceration is something that has been on the tongues of a lot of people. Solitary confinement, solitary housing unit, SHU, and the other one is, what's the other term?
Restricted
housing. Restricted housing units, excuse me. These terms are becoming more common in our conversations around mass incarceration. So we're not just talking about the deplorable conditions and the sheer exorbitant number of people who are imprisoned in U.S. prisons, but also the torture that then takes place within these prisons, where men and women are kept at inordinate amounts of hours by themselves in poor conditions with limited food, limited access to physical contact, limited access to food, limited access to the outside air. We're all enjoying, we may be sweating, we may be hot, but at least we have the freedom to be in the space and to feel the breeze from outside. Imagine spending hours, after days, after weeks, after months, after years in spaces where you can't even see fresh air. What does that do to the human body, and what does that do to the human soul? In 2006, this courageous brother here, along with five other brothers at SCI Dallas, decided to challenge the policies that were going on there, to challenge what they saw in terms of the deplorable conditions. And because of that, because they used peaceful protests to expose the injustices of the of SCI Dallas, they were then targeted and charged with rioting. To this date, members of Dallas 6, as they've been called, are still fighting their charges against SCI Dallas and these rioting charges. And I know that Derek will speak a little bit more about his personal experience with regards to this. One of the young men today, just recently today, Dwayne Shani, was telling me, and I saw on Facebook a post earlier, that his 10 boxes of evidence, which he's been carrying around for the last few years, which clearly indicts this system and this state, they're now trying to find ways to even take that evidence from him and try to get him to ship his boxes elsewhere when in fact he has legal rights to keep those boxes with him. So these are the things that we're talking about today. We're not just talking about mass incarceration, but we also want to shine some light on another aspect of mass incarceration that's not always highlighted. So I'd like to introduce our panelists this evening, all who have some connection to fighting mass incarceration and this issue of police terrorism. I'll start at my far end with Lukman Abdullah. He is an activist and formerly served 23 and a half years of his life at some of PA's worst prisons, five of which were in solitary housing. More importantly, he's an activist, he's a mentor, he's a father, he's a social worker, he's formerly the prison care outreach specialist for FIGHT. He's a founding member of the HRC, the Human Rights Coalition, and he's also the senior vice president of Baptist Society. Let's welcome Lukman. To his right is Ms. Chandra Delaney. She's the coordinator for justice for the Dallas 6 support campaign and mother of Carrington Keys, who's one of the Dallas 6. She's been an advocate for human and civil rights and prisoners for 15 years. She's a member of the Human Rights Coalition and Abolitionist Law Center in Pittsburgh. Let's welcome Chandra. To her right is Ms. Teresa Schultz. She's the daughter of current political prisoner Russell Maroon Schultz, who served 40 years inside Pennsylvania's prisons, 35 of which were in solitary. 30 years in solitary, excuse me. Teresa has fought tirelessly for her father's freedom, donating her time to the Human Rights Coalition of Philadelphia, documenting the abuse inside the prison in the present day system. She's a community activist who has an open door policy, taking in foster children of all ages. I've borne witness to that. It's a beautiful thing. And the NAACP Greater Ferd Prison Chapter honored her for her commitment to you. Let's welcome Teresa. Last, but certainly not least, to my left is Mr. Derek Stanley. As a Dallas 6 member who survived 10 years in the special management unit at SCI Camp Hill, where both guards and prisoners were known to kill themselves rather than to endure the day-to-day deplorable conditions that existed at the prison. Despite describing his experience in solitary as being like hell, Derek filed a steady stream of grievances and complaints against prison guards and officials challenging the practice of abusing prisoners physically and or mentally for years on end, standing firm in his belief that even prisoners have human rights. Derek maintained his position all the way out of the front door of the prison after serving 22 years. Unbroken. Let's welcome Derek. So I've provided a little bit of groundwork for this conversation, but I'd like to offer you all about 10 minutes each to speak a little bit more about mass incarceration as it relates to solitary confinement and the conditions we're in, and then also speak a little bit more about your work and how it relates to this issue. So whoever's most comfortable, can you please start?
And the reason why I want to start is because I'm approaching 51 years of age next month. And my dad has been in prison, it's going on 42 years. He's 71 years of age. And I've been going into prison for almost 40 years now. So I always say I grew up in the prison. And when I say that, it's because early on as a child, I did have access to my father. I was able to touch him. And the prisons were a whole lot different. And so when I used grow up, I grew up in a prison. It often, by the end of this conversation, will change to whereas I would visit my dad as a little girl, and I thought the prison was such a wonderful place. They were well manicured lawns and the floors were shiny. And I thought my dad had all these people working for him. These guards were protecting him and that he was at this great job. It wasn't until one Christmas holiday, my uncle would give family members 50 cent pieces. And I mailed one to my dad. And of course, I didn't know he was in prison. Although I had visited him there, I didn't know anything about money order. And when he called, I was waiting for his response that he had gotten my 50 cent piece for Christmas. And he said, "Oh, baby girl, don't do that. One of the guards might have got it." But he didn't say it in a bad way, like, "One of those guards got that 50, don't do that, they stole the money," whatever. He just said it in a nice way, but in my mind, I took it in a bad way. And I said, "This place is a nice workout," because I didn't know, you know. And I asked my mom, which my mom had never taken me to the prison, but she was totally against that scene for her kids to see. So his siblings always took me. And I had vowed that day, the first guard I see, I'm going to kick him straight in the balls. Just kick straight in the middle of the crotch. I said, "I'm going to kick the first guard I see." Because I didn't know which one had did it. And when I finally got a visit, I didn't tell anyone, my dad or my aunt. As soon as I walked into the prison, I kicked the first guard. And oh my God. They carried me out, two guards, one under the door, and he said, "What'd you do that for?" And I said, "You took my dad's 50 cents." And he said, "What 50 cents? What are you talking about?" So they carried me out. And the reason why I tell this story is because now I think of all the hundreds of thousands of children who have a loved one in prison. And had they kicked that guard, I was flying off of my emotions. But if a kid today kicks a guard, instead of them carrying me out and they say, "Oh, you're not going to see your daddy today," and they set me outside of the prison on the bench. And my aunts and them just went on into the visit and they left me outside. And I think today a kid would be locked up. A kid today would be sent to a detention center with maybe facing a felon's charge, assault charge, and would be looking at some time. And so now I started taking their foster children, because most foster children are affected by the prison system or the drugs in the communities, or the mothers are in prison. And I said, I have to reach out to those kids because I was that little kid. But now, when I talk to these kids that come in my home, I've taken their 15 kids in less than 2 years. Some are confused by the prison system. Some of them think they're going to belong there one day. So that's why I started doing that. Now, prison started changing when my dad started becoming recognized as an educator. Because before it was all nice. You would go to the prison and they would have all kind of activities for you. You could bring your food into the prison. They had all kind of picnics. There were so many men around me who were getting college degrees in the prison, and I still see those men to this day. And every one of my men that was in the prison when my dad got a degree never returned. And all of those programs are wiped out now. They're just gone, and prisoners are just being housed. Now, I'm going to go into a section of the abuse of solitary confinement. My daddy had always seemed upbeat to us and tried to educate us as much as he could, my siblings and I, from behind bars, as best as he could, until he was elected the first black president of an all-white prison-approved lifers group at SCI Pittsburgh. And he was allowed into this visit and he just started talking. And this all-white group accepted him and asked him later on to become president of their group. Even the guards, I was told, would come in, lock the doors, and they would sit and listen to my dad. Well, the warden came down and once my dad was voted the first black of this group to take the vote back. No one would take the vote back, none of the prisoners. The prisoners also went on a hunger strike to keep my dad as the president. That didn't work. They sued the prison because this was a prison-approved gathering. And then my dad was told, if this vote isn't taken back, you're being shipped out of here. And he was in solitary ever since. That's why he went to solitary. Now, if you know the history of Russell Maroon Schultz, or you look it up later today, he escaped from prison twice. He said, I'm just not going to be here. I'm liberating myself whenever I get a chance. This is not the crime. I didn't do it. They know who did it. Just because I'm political and I stood up for my community, I'm considered radical. And he was a member of the Black Panther. So he did escape. But he was always put back into population because he never hurt anyone on these escapes. And it wasn't until he was voted president. Now, this is what solitary can do to you. And then I'm going to close up. My daddy had forgot about that. Now, how do you forget that you were elected the first black president of an all-white lifers group? A prisoner told me, well, he said, oh, I hear you on this campaign trying to get your dad out of solitary. He's one of the longest held men in the country. And he said, but I'm hearing it's all about the escapes. I said, what are you saying it is? He said, no. Your dad was the first black president. The story I just told you, I had never heard until 3 years ago. So I asked my daddy, well, I had opportunity with him. He said, I don't remember that. He said, how do you not remember that? And it was because of that environment, of being in solitary. You lose your focus. You can lose your senses. You can lose your mind. And that's what forced me the last 7 years to start working for my dad because he was no longer smiling. Everything was so serious when I visited him. And I could see, I had even said, let me introduce you to a woman from the outside that can write you. He said, nope. He said, my five fingers have served me for, oh, it was almost 40 years. And I said, no, baby, you need someone. Because I could see he was going down. Now, he didn't give me fair warning about all these other prisoners. They come in strolling. He said, Teresa, he will call me. You got to get to this family. Talk to this prisoner's loved one. Because he's getting ready to lose his mind or he's going to kill himself. Because at SCI Green, we didn't hear much about it. Up close to Pittsburgh, this prison, over 10 guys in their 20s had hung themselves. In their 20s. And Daddy said they would come in strolling and he would try to yell to them. But you're so isolated far that try to keep your wheels spinning, do you have family or whatever, and next thing they would be walking like zombies or someone would kill themselves. now, and I'm opposed with how I'm at Lukemont. My dad called me and said I needed to pick him up from prison. He was being released. Well, I didn't know him, but my dad volunteers me for all of these missions to help other prisoners. We have the family members are so bogged down with just ordinary life, just trying to keep a roof over their head. Or some of them are so afraid to approach these prisons or prison officials. Well, whereas I'm not. I'm just out there. I'm very bold. And I said, who is the guy? He said, you've got to pick them up because they've got them so dirty here. And it gets me emotional because my dad really felt that you were going to kill somebody once you were released. And it gets me so emotional because when I drove, 8 hours to pick them up from this place called SCI Farm, Fayette, it was the only lights. We were out there like 5 in the morning. The only lights in the town was the prison. Because we were like, where's the prison? And we were like, in the distance, it was like so desolate. And when they told us to get off the property until the doors opened, when I finally walked into the prison, I walked right by. This guy had changed. And that's another thing, the Hill Proudly, or you can look up how solitary changes, not only mentally, your physical, your look. The daddy said, I didn't know me, and sent me photos and stuff. I walked right by. Went straight to the desk, and they put him up to the guards. And then I drove from out of there and talked to him, and you know, that's how we got to know each other. And I do this all the time, but, and so I thank you for taking the time to listen. Thank you.
Thank you for doing that. So we say, we want you to remind us, since this is kind of giving you a natural segue, we want to see what you think of the citizens.
So good evening. Thank you, Teresa. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you for having us. My name is Lukeman Abdullah. About 33 years ago, I went to prison. Well, 33 years ago, my brother was murdered on the streets of Philadelphia. And I was charged with taking a life. I was falsely accused of taking the life of the guy who murdered my little brother. I went to prison, spent 23 years in prison. Took many years for me to get my life sentence overturned. I ended up with lawyers, robbed my family out of about $30,000. And I met a guy in Pittsburgh who said to me that we need to work on our case. I was naive, I was ignorant to the law, I wasn't conscious. So I began to go to the law library with this gentleman and start studying the law. During the course of that time, I became politicized. Some of the organizations, Big Speed Bars, Anarchist Black Cross, Scott Lambs, and Tim Fassler, a lot of them would send me a lot of literature and stuff. Before he passed away, would send me a lot of literature to be politicized. And one of the things about being in Pennsylvania prisons or prisons around the world, once you become politicized, you then become a threat to the institution or to the establishment. Once you become conscious, once you begin to see what this system, the structure of this system, and what this system is built on, you become a threat. You know, the prison guards don't appreciate prisoners who become conscious, prisoners who become revolutionized, you know, and a lot of times they'll use various tactics to get you out of isolation and even murder you. So during the course of my struggles in prison, becoming conscious, becoming politicized, I was at SCI Rockview. I was up at SCI Rockview with Phil Africa. He used to be one of my boxing trainers. We used to run the yard together. And I was in correspondence with some of the MOVE members who were out in society. And what happened was one year they was about to, they was planning on executing Mumia. So me and Phil was kind of close. I was receiving letters from the MOVE organization, different organizations. So what happened was the institution took Phil out of general population, and then they took me out of general population under a false pretense saying that I was threatening to burn the jail down if they executed Moon. They shipped Phil out of the institution, and then they shipped Phil to Dallas. They sent me to SCI Green. When I got the SCI Green, it kept me locked down in solitary confinement for about a year. Then they put me in general population. I went out in general population. They falsely accused me of threatening the prison guard and the prison guard's family. The prison guard came to my hearing and testified that I never was a problem on the unit. They still denied me access to general population. And while I was in solitary confinement, even when I appealed it to Camp Hill, the institution said that they would not let me out in general population because they could not protect somebody by alternative measures, something to that effect. So anyway, during the course of this time is when I actually met Russell Schultz. Now for years, Russell Schultz was a legend. Maroon was a legend in the prison system. You know, his revolutionary politics and stuff. So when they put me in solitary confinement next door to him, we were having geography classes. It was about maybe 7 or 8 of us. Maroon had us learn the whole map of the world. And he would test us. We had to say the countries, the continents and everything without a cheat sheet or anything. The guards began to attack us for that. They began to attack us, saying that we couldn't be on the door with no study and so forth and so on. Then they came, they said we had too many books in our cell, so they stripped us of all the books and reading material we had, and said we only could have 10 books. Along with that, it was freezing cold in the solitary confinement cell. It was freezing cold in those cells. Can you imagine, how many of y'all can imagine just standing in the bathroom for about 23 hours a day? Nobody can imagine that? But that's what it's like being in solitary confinement, being in the bathroom 23 hours a day in a freezing cold cell with freezing cold air blowing on you 24 hours a day. And sometimes if they want to torture you, they'll leave the light on. And they'll leave the light on. So we had to wear our socks on our hands to keep warm. With the towel that we had to put our towels around our necks. Sometimes we had to jam the water faucet so the steam from the hot water can generate some heat or humidity in the cells. Sometimes they would let us out in the yard. Sometimes if they was a little angry with us, they wouldn't give us our 1 hour yard activity. However, Russell Maroon Schultz stayed on us about becoming conscious, becoming educated, politicizing ourselves, and staying strong. Because we've seen so many individuals come in there, commit suicide. There's been issues where the guards have actually murdered individuals in those institutions. I give my, after leaving SCI Green, when they found out they couldn't keep me locked down any longer, they sent me to SCI Huntington. SCI Huntington said that they wouldn't take me. So they sent me back to Rockview, an institution where they took me out of. They kept me there for about a week, and then they decided to send me to SCI Dallas. I got to SCI Dallas. They kept me in solitary confinement for about 4 months. And after the 4 months, they let me out in general population. I was in general population there for about 70 days. They said that I was organizing other prisoners in the prison. So they locked me and 7 other individuals down, and that's when we became the Dallas 7. And they kept us locked down they kept me and 3 of the other gentlemen locked down for about a year and a half, and that's when they sent me to Pittsburgh. Got to Pittsburgh, they kept me in a hole for about 3 months, and they let me in general population. From there, they opened up New Fayette Jail, and that's where I went and I got released. However, how many of you are familiar with the Iraqi prisoner abuse? How many of you are familiar with Charles Green, who was a Pennsylvania prison guard and an Army reservist? Well, Charles Brainerd was one of the ones that tried to murder us at SCI Green. And when we were reporting out, telling people about the abuse that was going on at SCI Green, a lot of people didn't believe us. A lot of people didn't believe that we were being abused at SCI Green. And it took him to go all the way to Iraq to get charged with abusing Iraqi prisoners. And some of the same methods that they were using at Iraq, they were using against prisoners in Pennsylvania. You know, prisons right now is a multi-billion dollar operation. However, they find money for prisons, but they're not finding money for the schools to educate our children. They're closing schools, but they're building prisons. Why? Prisons are just like hotels. They build them so that they could place bodies in them, so that they could utilize that space. But I want to say something that Teresa said. I mean, Nick mentioned, I may be one of the ones who studied under my room in those prisons, who came home and got my master's degree. You know, I continue to educate myself. I'm in a position now where I have hands on young people, where I can expose them to political education, because right now our children need help. And we talk about prisons, we talk about mass incarceration, but we have to begin to talk about the prevention. And the prevention is working with our young people in the communities so that they don't go to prison, so that they don't put themselves in a position where the bogus police or the rogue police or what have you can put them in a situation where they can lock them up, abuse them, murder them, and put them in prison. That's where the abolishing of the prisons come in there, preventing our children from going to prison. Because I work with 61 schools in the school district of Philadelphia. And some of the things that I see going on with our young people and how some of our young people are being dumbed down and not being empowered, not being informed, not being taught about their greatest potential and their abilities is a shame. And we are the ones, each one of you and each one of us, have a responsibility to get with the young people so that they don't get trapped up in this system. Because we have a prison system that don't care nothing about names, don't care nothing about faces. Some people may escape if you have money, some people. But when you politicize, you become a number one enemy in this society. And we can look at history, and history could show you that anybody who become politicized and oppose the system, let's look at what J. Edgar Hoover said. Do not let the rise of the black Messiah raise up in the black community. So that was just talking about somebody who was conscious and politicized. Look at the history of the Black Panther Party. Look at the history of RAND. Look at what they did to the MOVE organization here in Philadelphia. So, I have 1 minute, one more minute, while I cut it right here. So I thank y'all for listening to my rambling.
Your brains are turning. You probably have quite a few questions already. There will be time for Q&A towards the end of the program. So if you do have questions, I encourage you to write it down so that you don't forget. Already in my mind, I have questions for you also. I'm sure you all do as well. So I'd like to just hand the floor over to Chandra to speak about her experience with regards to mass incarceration and solitary confinement.
I'd like to pick up where he left off talking about prevention. Because my son went into prison when he was 18. But before that, it started off in the school to prison pipeline. And I really didn't know, I didn't know about school to prison pipeline, but that's, now that I know about it now, that's what actually happened to him. But he started getting in trouble when he was maybe about 12 or 13. And I was calling everywhere around the city in Pittsburgh, saying, can you help me with my kids? Is there a mentor or anything like that? And everybody told me, we can't help you until he's adjudicated. So that means they're not going to do anything for you until you're locked up. So that's kind of what ended up happening to my son. He went through a series of programs until he eventually, what they call it, a failure to adjust. But what it was, he was a little kid and he had an emplacement and he wanted to go home. And so they would give him all these different diagnoses or whatever, and keep passing them on to different programs. So by the time he got 18, I kept trying to tell him, you cannot get into any more trouble now, because they will send you away to prison. So he ended up getting in trouble with one of his friends. And what happened, there was him and a friend of his went into, there was a bar in our neighborhood that didn't allow black people in the bar. And I always told him, don't go near there or anywhere around there. Him and his friend were drinking and decided to go in there. And they had a gun and they shot the gun in the air. And they would end up being charged with robbery, even though they didn't rob anything. And I didn't know at the time, you know, I didn't know what to do. I got beat out a lot of money by an attorney, too. And I was only making, like, minimum wage. And he took all my money. And end up, there were other people, there were other robberies that had occurred. And they tried to, there were three more robberies, and they tried to blame them, clean the books and blame them for those robberies. But that didn't happen. The people, you know, denied that it was them, said that it was not them. But one of them, they actually went, and they did some type of way where they showed the picture of my son where he would pick him as the person who did it or whatever. And so the judge, she had a trial by the judge, and the judge gave him, ended up giving him 5 to 20 years because they had tried to get him to take a plea deal, and he was like, well, I'm innocent. So I'm not going to take a plea. And they end up giving 5 to 20 instead of the 5 to 10 that he would have got. Once he got in there, I started feeding him with books about self-knowledge, and he met a lot of older guys, you know, that were teaching him self-knowledge about himself. And he became, you know, he became proud of himself, and he started teaching himself and educating himself. And that's when he became politicized. He was reading newspapers. He was reading the Final Call and newspapers like that. And after 9/11, they decided that those newspapers were racist, so they would not allow those papers in. And my sons at that time started filing lawsuits. He filed lawsuits after lawsuit, and he was winning. She was winning like grievances against the things that they were doing. And at that time, he began to be harassed. So at that point, he got into an altercation with another inmate, and he was supposed to be in solitary for 9 days. This was around May 2002. He got in solitary, and he ended up being in there for 10 years. Because once he got in there, he became a jailhouse lawyer. He helped a lot of people win cases, and he had a lot of cases in the court, and they don't like that. People like that harass you more, they torture you more, and they keep you in solitary confinement even longer. Like, they make up things to keep you in there. He got in trouble for covering his life. That was an infraction. You can't cover, he wanted to cover his window because he didn't want somebody seeing him. Restroom. He got in trouble for that. Then he started getting accused of assaulting the guards, but meanwhile it was the other way around. The guards were assaulting him. He got assaulted so many times, we were filing complaints with the state police, I've contacted every senator I could think of, anybody in government. And what happens when you try to do that, everybody sends the information back to the prison for the prison to investigate themselves. And of course, they investigate themselves, and they didn't do anything wrong, just like they do out here on the streets. Another thing I want to bring up, too, the cameras. Like, okay, everybody's talking about the cameras, how, you know, they want the police to have body cameras or whatever out here. Well, in my opinion, it's going to end up being the same thing, because in prison, they have cameras on people. What they do when they go in there and assault the prisoners, before they even get in there, they say, stop resisting, stop resisting. Yeah. Meanwhile, they're the ones beating on you. And so, then what happens too, whenever there's a favorable, where it could be a favorable decision on the inmate's behalf, the camera seems to have a malfunction. all the time. And this happens at every single prison. The cameras have malfunctioned. And at one time I told, I was on a panel before the, some people from the DOC or whatever, and I said, maybe you guys need to invest in some different cameras, you know, because they're always having malfunctions.
Well, maybe they work the way they're supposed to work.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, as far as the $1.06, for my son being transferred to so many prisons, and with him being a jailhouse lawyer, anytime there's any type of unity among you and other prisoners, they transfer to other places. So he ended up getting transferred to SCI Dallas, where he ran into a group of young men who were all doing the same thing he were. They were the type of people that did not back down. They stood up for whatever was going wrong. They were jailhouse, most of them were jailhouse lawyers, and they were very good jailhouse lawyers. So I think before he got there, he was at SCI Mahanoy for a very long time in solitary there. And I was on a first name basis with Jeffrey Beard, who was the secretary at that time. I was writing, faxing, emailing, calling him like at least once a week because there was so much stuff going on. And at one point, my son received, he wrote me a letter and he said, Mom, I found some glass in my food. He might even sent me a piece of glass, I can't even remember. And I immediately called Jeffrey Beard and I said, you know what's going on because I've been in contact with you. And you need to get my son out there now because they're trying to kill him. And he moved my son to SCI Dallas. And once he got to Dallas, I got on the phone with people there and I said, my son has been through hell, and it's not because of his doing, it's because of your guards doing. You need to let him out into general population. And at that time, it was a Vincent Looney, who was one of the biggest terrorists. But at that time, he agreed, and he did let him out in solitary. But being that he had lawsuits against a lot of the guards, we went out to yard and come back, and they shook up his cell looking for contraband. But what they were doing was taking the legal work and the evidence against them. Like she was saying, like they've done to Dwayne, they've also done to my son again with the $1.06 case. But just to, Derek will be able to tell you more about it because I don't want him to tell you what really happened on that day. But all the guys did was cover up their cell door window, and they were the ones that were beat down, and they're the ones that are being charged with bribery. And we've been fighting this case for about 5 years. 5 years we've been, it's getting a lot of national attention. The city where the case is being held is Luzerne County, and this is the same county where the Kids for Cash scandal took place. Mm-hmm. And believe me, when I go into that county, you will recognize that corruption is the status quo in Luzerne County. I don't even think they know how to do anything above board or legally. I know that for a fact that when the prisoners are sending certified letters there to file complaints against these COs and all of that, they're disappearing. And I've seen it happen to too many people. And so there's got to be a connection between the post office there and the courthouse, because I've traced stuff. It gets to the post office, but it don't get no further. And people's court cases are being, they're not because they can't get served. So the court cases are being like wiped out, and they're acting like they don't even exist. And this is the same thing that's going on with the $1.06 case. The judge, the DA, the state police, all of them are working together to. They all came together to bring this riot charge about. My son had actually, the $1.06 incident happened on April 29, 2010. In July, my son filed a civil lawsuit against the district attorney of Luzerne County, and the HRC filed a criminal complaint against Luzerne County. Not Luzerne County, but against the guards for abusing the inmates. the criminal complaintment to the state police. The state police had this criminal complaintment to, took the complaint to the DLC. The DLC, the district attorney that my son was suing, and the state police, they came together and made a fake charge of riot for the guys, and that's where they came together.
Hello. I just want to make sure you're hearing me. My name is Derek. I'm not only one of the Dallas Six, but I'm not just a human being that, you know, I'm sure you're going to be able to relate to. I'm going to try to fill this in a nutshell. I just want y'all to know that I'm a strict opponent of tyranny. Like Abraham Lincoln, when he was young, he was like that against tyranny. But, and I want y'all to understand tyranny. We don't hate all authority. It's the fact, the tyranny is the fact that authority at their discretion could do right and wrong. But, you know, they'd rather be wrong than right. And that part of the authority is what I hate among other people with dislike, to use a, you know, more way of speaking. And in this particular case with the Dallas Six, you know, like what he was saying, like, you know, you're inside of the conditions, you depend on these people, your life is in their hands, their authority to feed you, to make sure you get recreation, you know, everything. You depend on people to get your meal, stuff like that. Now, in this particular case of the Dallas 6, April 29, 2010, you know, before this particular incident happened, you know, I was just, I'm real quiet, just observing what was going on around me, like, you know, and being in solitary confinement, you know. So in this particular case, you know, reference which came about on April 29, 2010, like, you know, her son and other gentlemen was just like he was saying, like, we just, you know, just relate to each other, you know, they was through the vents. That's why I call them the vents, because you can't relate out the doors to crack the glass. Like he was saying, you know, and in the wintertime, it's like you're living in a freezer inside of a bath, to be more specific, you know. So because you can just imagine living inside of one of the freezers, and then in the summertime, it's like you're living inside of an oven, you know, since hot, instead of the air conditioning, it's supposed to be all the way around anyway, in these conditions, you know. I guess two things happen. You could become better or you become worse. And instead of them rehabilitating you to become better, it seemed like they punished you so you could become worse and treat you bad. This is what I see just from, you know, being in those situations. Mm-hmm. So when I see the way they treat other people, you know what I mean? I usually mind because I ain't got nothing to do with that. But it's just the situation that I was, just things that I was seeing was so, I couldn't just turn a deaf ear and blind ear to it. You know, but that's not me. I don't have to worry about that because it got so out of hand, so crazy that I had to pay attention to it. And then it did change to me. Like, you know, like the way these other treating other people, like this one particular elder Caucasian gentleman, you know, he was crazy. But he was like an Einstein, he was real wise. I forgot his name, but this particular gentleman was like, you know, he's in a guard cell with cameras and stuff like that. But they would always mess with him in the guards. Kill yourself. I'm gonna kill myself. So one particular night they took him out of the camera, the cell, which is guarded by, you know, cameras to protect him. Took him out the cell, put him in another cell, and, you know, showed up and killed himself. And he tried to sneak his body past at nighttime. Then I was like, oh, this is getting out of hand. That, along with, you know, burning other people on the chair for speaking up what they did to this particular elder, you know, Cajun gentleman, you know, coercing him to kill himself. And then he did kill himself. So then everybody on the chair like, yo, that's wrong, what you doing? Mind your business. That's what they used to say to me. Mind your business, you don't have nothing to do with that. You know, don't you want to get out the hole? Don't you want to do this? Don't you want to do that? Don't you want to go home? Okay, this and that. Or, you know, anyway, when the gentleman killed himself, other people started responding, putting in paperwork, filing grievances. We was going by the right way. You know, filing grievances, you know, paperwork and stuff like that. They take the grievances never go in. They don't even file a grievance. You got to give them to one guard, then they disappear. You know, the grievances, all the paperwork and stuff like that. Anybody after that, what they're doing is like, look, either you mind your business or we're gonna make you pay. So they started depriving dudes of their food, taking people mail, reading them out, you know, like you write my family members, my friends on the street, y'all write me a letter, they'll take the letter and, you know, another dude down the hall, they'll read, give him the letter down the hallway, read the letter on the loudspeaker, give people my people's address where they writing perverted crazy stuff or whatever like that, you know, make stuff disappear, rip the letter right in front of your face, stuff like that. You know, tell you these is little things they did. Then, you know, I started finding grievances like I was supposed to do, you know. You know, it's a code of ethics you're supposed to go by.